Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome to All of It. I'm Nancy Giles, filling in for Allison Stewart. So how many times have you heard someone say that the internet is destroying language, that texting is making us worse writers, or that communicating through emoji is sending us backwards in time? My next guest is a linguist, and she lives on the internet, as she writes in a new book, and she says that language is always and has always been changing. And in that way, the internet is no exception. Glad to hear that. She writes, quote, "When future historians look back on this era, they'll find our changes just as fascinating as we now find innovative words from Shakespeare or Latin or Norman French. So we might as well start looking now." Gretchen McCulloch is the resident linguist at Wired, co-host of the podcast Lingthusiasm. Wait, did I say that? Okay, Gretchen, you'll help me with that. Lingthusium. And now the author of Because Internet, Understanding the New Rules of Language. In her book, she discusses what appeals to us so much about emoji, why a single period can entirely change the meaning of a sentence to certain people, and how memes are and have been reborn throughout history. And she also looks at how the internet is turning more people than ever before into writers and making the way we write more emotive. And she joins me now to talk about it. Gretchen, welcome to All of It.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so let's start with, how do you say what your podcast is?
It is, you got it right the first time. It is Lingthusiasm.
It is Lingthusiasm. Okay.
A podcast that's enthusiastic about linguistics. And then we realized very belatedly that it's very hard to say out loud, which is maybe a bad thing for something on the air.
I was looking at it and it was like, Lingthusium? Anyway.
No, you're good.
Okay. Oh, good. Now, how does the internet, in your opinion, democratize language? And does it indeed do that?
Yeah, it's really interesting because before the internet, if you wanted to reach a large number of people, particularly in a written format, you needed some sort of access to means of production, a printing press, or, you know, maybe a radio station, or these kinds of things that, you know, enabled you to reach a large crowd. Whereas at this point, you know, anybody can be essentially a quote-unquote published author. If you define being published as, say, 100 people see something you've written, then anybody who's made a Facebook post being like, oh yeah, I have a new job, you know, thanks for all the happy birthday wishes. You know, it's pretty easy to get 100 people to see something that you've written now. That used to be really hard.
Right. You know, okay, so the way that this conversation is framed a lot of the time is how the internet is changing language. But is it the internet, or is it specific groups, or I mean, aren't we the internet? So isn't it us as humans that are actually changing how we communicate?
Yeah, the internet is a sort of, one way of looking through it. But what I'm really interested in is kind of the bigger question of the growth of informal writing. So if you think about like 50 years ago, the average person didn't actually write that much after you left school. Like, unless you became a professional writer, most people, the average amount that they would write would be maybe a grocery list or a, you know, postcard, note on the kitchen table, yeah, I fed the dog kind of thing. A lot of people didn't actually write that much. And so the fact that we're all writing so much more in ways that are unfiltered by an editor or these kinds of things that kind of impose a very homogenized way of writing just leads to this incredible expansion of opportunities for how people can write.
Well, that's something to know. I mean, I know I write a lot. I used to, I'm realizing, write a lot of letters. But I guess for most people, you're right. After they have to write, they don't write.
Yeah. And, you know, some people wrote letters or wrote journals, but not everyone did this. It wasn't, you know, whereas now you can't even organize like a birthday party without texting.
That's true. What role does, for lack of a better way of putting it, cultural appropriation or even colloquial expressions, what role do they play in the way that the internet can change language?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a big, you know, something that I was kind of careful to look at in the book was that there's a lot of words that people associate with, like, oh, these are internet words that are actually appropriations from African American English. But that's not unique to the internet. That's been happening for, you know,
centuries
before the internet. And it's something that can maybe happen more on the internet because it's easy, you know, for me as a white person to go creep on Black Twitter or something in a way that's maybe not something that's actually a respectful thing to do.
You're excused for the purpose of this conversation. Please continue.
But there's this weird dynamic where you can, you know, like creep on a group, whether that's young people or whether that's, you know, marketers creeping on fans, trying to say like, what do they think about our show? And you can see things that are going on in groups you aren't necessarily a part of. But, you know, so there's kind of a couple of things that can happen there. And one is that the internet can create more weak ties, which spread things beyond the kind of dense network groups where they can originate and into other groups. So something can go viral faster. Words can go viral the way that a, you know, funny video can also go viral.
Right. I was going to ask you about those strong ties and weak ties. Can you explain a little, elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah. So strong ties are, you know, sort of dense network connections where if you have a strong tie with someone, you have a lot of friends in common with them.
Okay.
So they're densely embedded into your network. If you're a weak tie with someone, you don't have a lot of friends in common. You're, you know, they're somebody that...
like friends of friends of friends.
Well, not even just friends of friends of friends, but also just like, you know, the person you buy a coffee from.
Oh, okay.
Right? Maybe you see them every day,
that's weak.
But you don't have
yeah.
any friends in common.
Okay.
So... you know, strong ties, you're more likely to pick up new bits of language from strong ties, but they're also, you're already more likely to talk the same way as each other.
I see.
Because you have you're exposed to the same kind of information. Whereas weak ties, you're less likely to pick stuff up, but when you do, it can cross social groups.
I see, because it's a weaker tie and you're going to into depths you don't even know you're going to, going where no man has gone beyond, you know, before, like Star Trek theme.
Yeah, so they're sources of new information. And the one of the original studies that looks at this, it's a sociologist known as Granovetter, he found that people are more likely to find new jobs via weak ties than via strong ties, because your strong ties, like, if they all had a job that you could get, you would have already known about it.
Oh, that's true. True.
Whereas you're more likely to find out about a new job opportunity from, like, a friend of a friend of a friend, or, like, somebody you knew back way back when but you don't really talk to, because they have access to more new information than you do.
Okay.
And the same thing goes for language change.
I'm jumping around a lot because there's so much information here. How often can you trace a word that's coined on the internet, like LOL? Like, how often can you find where that word was first used?
Yeah, it depends on kind of what sorts of records happen and whether it's a new word particularly or whether it's a reuse of an existing word, which can make it really difficult to find through search at any rate. So LOL, the story goes that it comes from this guy in a chat board in Calgary in the 1800s, in the 1980s, not the 1800s.
I was going to say the 1800s.
Some stuff is surprisingly old. LOL is not one of those.
Okay.
But 1980s, which, so this story fits the facts that we can verify, mm-hmm. but we don't have the specific records of the exact conversation that he had, because in the 1980s, you know, storage was very expensive. You know, stuff was being stored on like reel-to-reel magnetic tapes at this point.
Wait a minute. I didn't even realize that there were such a thing as chat rooms, quote unquote, in the 80s. So what was that? Where? How?
Most of these were known as bulletin board systems or BBSs.
Okay.
And they're really poorly archived. There were hundreds of them. But they were, you kind of dial in with your phone to this sort of local, like regional bulletin board system where you can talk to specific people, kind of like a forum or a chat thing, but it's they're a lot more regional and you're dialing in with your phone, and this
All right.
is pretty obscure. So this is before what we think of as websites or the web, and this is when you just have sort of the internet of networked computers. But the kind of thing that this actually looks like is, you know, it's like green, glowing green words on a on a black monitor. It's very Matrix-y. There's a simulator of one of these BBSs that you can go and play with online. I wish I remembered the URL, but I did go and play it to when I was researching the book to say, like, what was it like when people were exchanging messages with each other on
that
these
That is freaky
old
sounding. Wow. So, you know, sometimes people don't even consider these internet terms as real language until it's in a dictionary. So in your opinion, how does that misunderstand what the purpose of dictionaries are?
So dictionaries are really following behind us and trying to keep up with the new words that we come up with or the new meanings of existing words that we come up with.
They're following us.
They're following us. They are just recording the language as we're creating it, because the language exists in the minds of its speakers and in the kind of community of its speakers together. And, you know, dictionary is just playing catch up constantly. It's like a guidebook. Like, a guidebook is always going to be a little bit out of date.
Okay.
Because, you know, you can start up a business. You don't have to get permission from the guidebook.
So the subtitle of your book, Because Internet, is Understanding the New Rules of Language. So, okay, in that sentence, what does the word rules mean? Who's making these rules?
So we often think of language rules as sort of these, you know, from on high, you know, thou shalt not do this sort of thing. But what I'm really interested in is the emergent rules. So the patterns that show up when you have a bunch of people talking to each other, even though we may not be aware that we're actually doing things in a pattern sort of way.
Okay.
So if you take key smash, for example, you know, you bang your fingers against the keyboard, it looks pretty random. But when I asked,
I'm sorry, I'm laughing. When you said key smash, I was like, wait, is that a term? And you meant, oh, literally banging your...
Banging, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Please, go on.
You know, like ASDF.
Right, blah, 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 JKL Simi.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah.
And it turns out that the majority of people actually don't just bang their fingers against the keyboard and hit send. They bang their fingers against the keyboard, and then they look at it, and they think, do I want to adjust this a little bit so it looks like better randomness?
Right.
Or maybe I'm going to redo this completely because I don't like how this random one showed up. And so most people aren't actually sending pure, unfiltered key smash. They're adjusting it to make it more socially legible to the people they're sending it to, even when we think we're trying to be, you know, a billion people typing randomly on a billion typewriters. We can't escape this, you know, impetus to behave socially with each other.
There still is some notion of wanting to organize these random thoughts into something. That's fascinating. Can we talk about punctuation? Because this is something that intrigues me. Why does using punctuation in texts or what you choose to use make people seem angry? And I guess I wonder about punctuation and then about the usage of caps, capital letters. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, punctuation can do a whole bunch of different things. And the thing that I find interesting is in the last couple decades, how we've moved towards using punctuation to convey different kinds of tone of voice. So if you take the period, for example, which, you know, has its history in sort of a neutral separator between sentences.
Right.
But because it's got this association with formal writing, it also creates a certain sort of solemnity or a certain sort of deepening of the voice at the end of a sentence. So if you know, as a radio host, say, and now over to the weather.
Period.
Period.
To the weather.
Yeah, you're deepening your tone at the end of every sentence because that's how you do, you know, an NPR voice.
Uh-oh, the secrets are out. All right.
The secrets are out. But that deepening of the voice in an informal context, and particularly in a text message or a chat where you don't have to put a period to indicate that you've finished a thought because you can just hit send. So because you have that option of just hitting send, the period can, if you've gone to the effort of sending putting a period there, you must mean something is the reasoning.
Is that right? Now, okay, go on. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and that connotation of the deepening of the voice. So if you say sounds good and you just hit send, that's kind of neutral.
Right.
But if you say sounds good.
Sounds good.
Sounds good. Are you really saying that sounds good?
Who knew that punctuation could have such a role in these things? What about, I'm a big ellipses user because I like that kind of like dot, dot, dot thing. I mean, what does that mean about me?
Yeah, so it means that you're
uncertain, you know, waffling.
Well, or potentially of a certain generation. One thing that people who use the ellipses, I think, often really like about it is that it's kind of splits the difference between two types of punctuation. So if you use a period or a semicolon, you're committing to each of your sentences being full clauses.
I see.
If you use a comma or sometimes a colon, you're saying these are actually, you know, dependent clauses. But the ellipsis and also the dash can be used to join either dependent or independent clauses. And so you're saying, look, I'm being kind of relaxed. I'm not committing to whether this is a dependent or independent clause. Either of these is fine. Here's my relaxed way of communicating.
I think I'm listening to you thinking my therapist is going to be so fascinated to hear this, as are certain relationships that have fallen apart in the past. I can't let you go without at least asking one quick question about emojis. Why do we love them so much?
The analogy that I like to use in talking about emoji is that they're like gesture. So they can, and a lot of the ways that they can contribute to what we're saying. So if you say something like good job with a thumbs up, whether that's an emoji or a gesture, you know, that reinforces the positive message.
Right.
If you say good job plus the middle finger.
Well, that's a whole different message.
Now you're sending a whole different message. We were able to add this level of double meaning with the gesture and the words that don't reinforce each other, that contradict each other, and that lets you communicate some of these tensions as well.
I see. Oh, my. This is fascinating. There's so much to still talk about. Like, let me just ask this as a last question. For someone who might not be that well-versed in the internet, will they be able to really understand your book?
You know, I had someone tell me that Their dad, who doesn't spend any time on the internet at all, was over at their house, picked up my book at the coffee table, and it was my friend's book, and like wouldn't give it back because he was so fascinated reading it and saying, I don't know anything about this, but I'm learning so much.
That's got to feel great.
Yeah. So I think it can be read by, you know, whether you see yourself or whether it's this kind of window into this world where you don't normally see yourself. I think it can be appreciated by both people.
I love it. I've been speaking with linguist Gretchen McCulloch about her new book, Because Internet. Gretchen, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.